Welcome to The Writing Life, the podcast for anyone who writes. I'm Steph McKenna, the Senior Comms and Marketing Manager here at NCW.
And I'm Holly Ainley, Head of Programmes and Creative Engagement. And we are coming to you today from Dragon Hall in Norwich, UNESCO City of Literature.
In this episode of The Writing Life, Holly speaks to novelist Michael Doncor about his new novel, Grow Where They Fall, and about crafting identity in fiction.
Michael Doncor was born in London to Ghanaian parents. He studied English at Wadham College, Oxford, followed by a master's in creative writing at Royal Holloway. His first novel, Hold, was longlisted for the Dylan Thomas Prize and shortlisted for the Desmond Elliott Prize. He is a frequent contributor to outlets including The Guardian, The TLS, and The Independent. And he is also an alumni of Escalator, which is National Centre for Writing's flagship talent development scheme for emerging writers. Michael participated in the programme back in 2015 and then has come full circle and now has been mentoring on the scheme for the past several years.
Yes, so we're very big fans of Michael and his work, and we love having him as a mentor on the Escalator scheme. This is also a really timely conversation because Michael is joining us in Norwich in May for the City of Literature weekend at Norfolk and Norwich Festival. Holly, do you want to tell us a bit more about what Michael is going to be up to with us in May?
Yes, we're really lucky to have Michael featuring twice on the programme over the City of Literature weekend. On Saturday, the 25th of May in the morning, he'll be with us at Dragon Hall to run a writing workshop on writing conflict in fiction. So a really interesting area there that he'll be getting into. It'll be suitable for emerging writers and for people who are perhaps a little bit more experienced, but who are really interested in honing their craft and digging deep into how it is that they present conflict effectively in their prose. And then later on in the day, on Saturday, 25th of May, Michael will be joined by another fantastic novelist, Santanu Bhattacharya, and they will be on a panel together discussing the themes of their latest novels and looking at identity in fiction and the effects of past lives, childhood events on their characters, and also kind of different forms of identity that they bring to their fiction. So they'll be looking at queer and racial identities, coming of age. So there'll be lots to discuss, and there'll be a chance for the audience to ask questions too. So we're really looking forward to those events.
And I know that places on Michael's workshop are already selling quite quickly, and his event in the evening with Santanu is one of my most anticipated events of the entire weekend. I love the City of Literature weekend at Norfolk and Norwich Festival. It's such a joy for us to program and to work on it each year. And this year we have 3 days of events, creative workshops and open spaces on that final weekend of May in Norwich, where we'll be celebrating all of the diverse range of voices in our community and we'll be exploring important questions of communication and representation. So we'll have lots of amazing authors of fiction, poetry and creative nonfiction, including Val McDermid, Karis Davis, John McGregor, Hannah Jane Walker, Michael Doncor, the list goes on and on and on. And we've also got lots of family-friendly interactive storytelling activities this year in the festival gardens as well as at Dragon Hall. And of course, on the final Sunday of the festival, we will bring back our popular publishing fair. So we'd love everyone to join us at Dragon Hall. You can explore local publishers and their writing. So to find out more about the City of Literature Festival, do head over to nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk and click on the What's On button. So Holly, let's move on to the main portion of our episode. Can you tell us a bit about what you discussed with Michael Doncor?
Gladly. Oh, I had such a fascinating conversation with Michael about his approach to crafting his character's identity in his fiction. So actually, I'd imagine some of the things we discussed might be topics that come up at his festival event with Santanu as well. So yeah, if you enjoy the chat today, then do consider coming along to the event. In our conversation, we talked about character perspective. We talked about how in Michael's new novel, Grow Where They Fall, We meet his protagonist at different ages and different stages of his life. And so we talk about how Michael used that narrative technique and what it can offer to writers. We also looked at representation of different kinds of characters that are available to us in the books we sort of see on our, in bookshops today. And also how much of an author's own identity they might bring to their writing. And then how a reader's own identity informs the way that they perceive a character. So we've really dug into some very interesting topics. So I hope you'll enjoy the conversation as much as I did.
So without further ado, let's hear from Michael Doncourt in conversation with Holly.
Michael, welcome to the podcast and to this episode on identity in fiction.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here today.
Yeah. And speaking of being here, well, I'm here in Norwich, but you are in Lisbon today.
I am.
How long have you been there?
So I moved to Lisbon with my husband in July 2022. So just over 18 months we've been here for. And it's a really extraordinary city and everything that we wanted it to be for us, and quite a literary city as well. So I've just started working in an English language bookshop actually down the road from our flat. So Lisbon and reading and writing have been sort of very beautifully enmeshed for me for the last 18 or so months. Yeah.
Amazing. Wonderful. A little bit jealous. So crafting identity in fiction, this is a big subject. And I think we'll probably talk quite a bit in our conversation about how you create characters, about representation, and I think also about how perspective and plot, and of course, your identity as an author, all inform your characters' identities. But I thought it would be interesting to start off the page and think first off about the identity of a reader and how a reader's identity might shape or be shaped by a work of fiction, in particular your novel Grow Where They Fall. I was thinking about it and thinking, if the story is effective, you know, if the book's well written, then at some deep level the identities that a reader encounters on the page can then have an effect on their own sense of self. And I wanted to start off by asking if you'd agree with that.
I think it's a big and very challenging question whether writers can impact identity. I think in relation to my own practice as a writer, I sometimes start off with that sort of idea, with the sense that as a creator, as someone putting something out into the world, it might touch a reader and it might sort of make them think about themselves or how they are in the world in slightly different ways. So yeah, it's an aspiration, I think, for lots of writers, myself included, that your work might inform or shape or change a reader's sense of themselves in some way. But I think that that aspiration sort of disappears once you get really into the writing process proper. Because for me, actually, engaging with the idea of the reader too closely when I'm writing is quite inhibiting, because it sort of means that I start anticipating all sorts of different responses or editing myself in line with what I think a particular person may or may not feel about what I'm producing. Those assumptions may well be entirely wrong. But I suppose that the real thing is that as I get more embedded in the writing process, it's the writing that takes precedent, and it's the characters and the challenges, revelations, difficulties that they're dealing with that is most central to me, as opposed to what the reader might feel afterwards. So I suppose that kind of impulse to wanting to shape a reader's identity or sort of move their identity on in some way is a starting point, but then it kind of moves to the wayside.
Yeah, and I guess you could say perhaps that then your sense of responsibility as a writer perhaps is shifting as well, and the responsibility is then to your characters to tell the story that you need them to tell.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have a lot of conversations with writers who are at the very beginning of their careers, or students who are doing creative writing degrees or masters. And a question that comes up a lot with those sorts of authors is to do with, am I the right person to tell this story? I might offend X group if I write this because I don't identify in this way. Should I tell this story or not? And I always say to that question, the responsibility first and foremost is to the work. You're writing it for its own sake, you're writing it for yourself at the beginning. There's a whole other conversation about reception and appropriation and all those big things, which is an important one to have. But in the first instance, I think your responsibility is to the page and what's going on the page. Because for me personally, there are so many factors that inhibit my ability to write. Self-criticism, doubt, the fact that I've got to go and take something to the dry cleaners, a sense that, you know, being a writer is an indulgent thing to do. All these things contrive to make me not write. Adding to that the sense of, oh gosh, I shouldn't be writing a story. It's too much. Sometimes you have to just take things away, take things off your plate so that you can get the writing done. And then later on, grapple with those big things of those bigger questions of authorship and whether it's right that you've told the story. But trying to free yourself up, I think, in whatever way you can to enable the writing process to begin is so important for me and I think for lots of other writers too.
Yeah, absolutely. And just sticking on reader identity for a minute, I mean, we're talking about that really close relationship there between writer and reader and the kind of writerly expectations. But actually, I was thinking about what expectations we might bring as a reader, because often we read precisely because we want to have our minds changed or we want to step into someone else's shoes. But at the same time as that, it's a bit of a duality because we are inevitably bringing our own preconceptions with us. So it's quite complicated what a reader wants and expects as well. And you can't possibly cater to all of that.
Totally. Yeah. And I think, you know, maybe this is a slightly cheeky thing to say, but if I'm ever really thinking about a reader's response to my work and trying to please a particular reader, that reader is me. That reader is me. So when I've written something and it makes me laugh, or I write a sentence and I think that's the truth of the matter, I think, yes, okay, good. So I'm the reader, and I sort of exist in a way where I kind of hope that readers out there have sensibilities that chime with my own. I hope that I reach readers whose sensibilities chime with my own.
Absolutely. I imagine we can talk a bit more about that relationship between writer and reader as our conversation goes on. But let's now think about character and identity. And of course, with this novel, at the heart of this novel is the wonderful character of Kwame, who, oh, I feel like he's just leapt off the page. And since finishing it, I feel like I know him. Tell us about Kwame.
I'm so glad you feel that way about Kwame. Character is the heart of the writing process for me. I don't start with plot. I start with a person I'm really fascinated with and go from there and see what story develops out of my relationship with this evolving person. So I'm always really thrilled when it's the people in the novel that readers connect with and that remember. That's what they remember about the narrative.
Absolutely. He's just a beautiful, lovely creation. And I wish he was my best friend.
So we meet Kwame at two stages of his life. So we meet him in 1997 when he's a 10-year-old boy, very precocious, imaginative, ambitious, wants to do the right thing, very concerned about doing the right thing and following rules, sort of bossy in some ways as well. And when we first meet him, one of the things that's really kind of occupying his mind is sort of being good at school. That priority is sort of added to when Kwame's cousin, Yao, arrives on the scene. So Yao is his 22-year-old cousin who comes over from Ghana to stay with Kwame and his family until Yao has got himself on his feet in the UK. And Kwame becomes fixated on the singularities and coolness of Yao, and their relationship and friendship blossoms really beautifully, I think. And it's a relationship that is the kind of which Kwame hasn't yet encountered in his young life, where there's a sort of older male role model who isn't a father or an uncle, somebody who's much closer to him in age, but not so close that their lives are parallel. And also this is a figure who's from Ghana, so there's that kind of cultural connection. But the ways that
that Yao talks about Ghana to Kwame are very different from the stories that Kwame hears from his parents about life back home. So that's Kwame as a 10-year-old. And then we also meet Kwame as a 30-year-old man, and he's now a teacher. He's a proud gay man, very happy teaching at a secondary school in South London. And his life as a 30-year-old English teacher seems fairly functional, sort of unremarkable. He lives with a very close friend of his from university, and that relationship is quite set in its ways, actually. So there's a dynamic between Kwame and Edwin, which has been in existence since essentially they met at university. And through his encounters with a new head teacher at the school, Marcus Felix, Kwame begins to look at his life a bit more closely, or at least he looks at it differently. And in particular, he looks at that central friendship with fresh eyes. And I suppose for me, what was really interesting about writing Kwame at these two seemingly distinct stages in his life was thinking about the continuities between this 10-year-old man and this 30-year-old man. You know, how much has Kwame grown up, I guess, is one kind of question. And equally, you know, what adultness did younger Kwame have that perhaps older Kwame does not have? So that sort of looking at how we develop, how we change, what we hang on to, what the world knocks out of us, what the world forces us to acquire in terms of characteristics as time goes on. Those are the sorts of questions I was really thinking about when building this person.
Yeah, and I think all of those things we really follow in great detail and with great pleasure through seeing Kwame's development. I want to just stick with that early life at the moment and think a little bit. So you've talked about the fact that Kwame's family are from Ghana. Thinking about his heritage and his roots, his parents are very traditional Ghanaian parents, as I understand it, and they're immigrants to London. But then Kwame himself he's second generation. He's a Londoner himself. And I wonder what that duality does for him or to him, to his identity.
Yeah, I think it is a duality that he struggles with, I suppose. I think it's a duality that he doesn't quite understand, and it's one that the world around him doesn't necessarily enable him to understand. And I mean the world around him both in terms of his family and in terms of school, which is the other kind of important context for him.
Yeah. So
I think for his family there's a kind of sense that he should be as Ghanaian as possible. And that's where their sense of him sort of following certain rules or behaving in a particular way comes from. And he feels that very keenly. When he's at school, his Ghanaian-ness isn't necessarily recognised, apart from at very particular moments when it's recognised in a way that he has no control over and it's kind of imposed on him. And it's a Ghanaian-ness that he doesn't recognise as being Ghanaian. So it's a kind of white confection of Ghanaian-ness, which is quite different from the Ghanaian-ness that he encounters at home.
Yeah, and there's some quite awkward moments almost in the classroom with his teacher, aren't there?
Absolutely.
That's very, very well drawn, and we as the readers feel like sort of sense of ick about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are moments when Kwame sort of becomes the token African figure in the classroom.
Yeah.
And those are moments where Kwame's white primary school teacher thinks that she's doing something wonderful by identifying him and celebrating his heritage in this particular way, but it's an unwelcomed, uninvited identification, and it's an identification that is not properly informed. So all of these things kind of come together to make Kwame feel unsure how to manage that duality. And I think there's something quite interesting about him as a child not knowing how to deal with sort of having these two different cultural spheres or two different kind of heritages, because that's something that grown-up second-generation immigrants also kind of wrestle with. It's not something that's particular to children. It's a sort of feeling that I think can last. And I suppose that in some ways is what is interesting for Kwame, or attractive for Kwame, about Yao, because he is a character who seems to inhabit his identity, his Ghanaian identity, so easily and calmly and with a sense of play. And I suppose there's a kind of idea for Kwame that that might be a way to exist in the world, to be able to inhabit all the bits of your life with joy and ease and with a proper sense of ownership. That's something that Kwame as a 10-year-old can't quite reach, but he can see a model for that in how Yao operates.
Yeah, and perhaps sticking on Yao for a moment, because I mean, a really big thing about this novel that delves into is the way that sort of those very formative childhood relationships and experiences, like with Yao, can complicate the way we feel about our identities and our sort of stories as adults. And I wonder if you could talk a bit more about how you use that relationship between Kwame and Yao to demonstrate Kwame's development, or to, for better or worse.
Yeah, I suppose Yao enters the novel as a kind of change-making force in some ways. So I hope that from the outset of the novel, or at the beginning of the novel, there's a real sense that this is what Kwame's life looks like. These are the routines of his life. This is his very kind of orderly, quite repetitive world. And then Yao arrives and encourages Kwame gently to kind of rethink some of the things that he takes as given, rethink some of his norms. And some of those norms are to do with success and what success looks like. Lots of conversations between Kwame and Yao about what it means to be in charge and what people might do and with power that they might have. There's lots of conversations also about kind of aspiration, I suppose. And before Yao's arrival, Kwame hasn't really needed, had the opportunity to think about a life sort of beyond his own. But Yao arrives in the UK with a real sense of kind of wanting to do something. So there's kind of a sense that that's a kind of new perspective that Kwame also has to kind of reckon with. And I suppose also there's that kind of sense of Kwame feeling a kind of pull towards Yao, but not really understanding it. And that's a really kind of central part of the way that their friendship works in the novel, is that it's a source of mystery for Kwame. He sort of senses that there's something dangerous about this fascination that he has with Yao, but he doesn't yet have the language for it, or he doesn't quite know what exactly it might mean. But then also, on the other hand, he has never felt the kind of warmth, openness, respect, and I suppose a kind of reciprocity that he feels with Yao. He hasn't encountered that before. Yao sees him very much as an equal. Yao really listens to what he has to say. Yao seems to be learning from Kwame as much as Kwame is learning from Yao. And that kind of sense of exchange, and the sense that Kwame might be a valuable and important person in the world, is very potent for Kwame. And yet it's kind of tinged with the sense of there's something forbidden about this, or something that he can't articulate to others. And I think that feeling of a secret, or concealing something, or feeling that some part of yourself is not appropriate for public display, is a really integral part for lots of queer people and their experience of growing up. And I think it takes quite a lot of work, good fortune, and love to sort of move away from that model of secrecy. And what we kind of see as Kwame grows up is that even though in lots of aspects of his life, he is very open and out there and confident, particularly in the classroom space, he's very much kind of in his element, or so he thinks. There are other aspects of his life where he's much more inward and holds things back and has this very kind of deep repository, internal repository of thoughts and feelings that he doesn't necessarily present to the world. And that is informed by that early experience of having this secret, this kind of series of intense feelings about Yao that he can't, or he senses he can't kind of put out there. So I guess that's one of the ways that, yeah, the kind of the relationship between Yao and Kwame is kind of, it plants the seeds for how Kwame develops as a person later on.
Absolutely. It's fascinating, isn't it? And the fact that you're able to use that sort of more childlike perspective in his childhood sections to, as you say, there's a sense of mystery and of not not having a language to describe yet what's happening. And it's really, really interesting to see how it pans out. And so we're getting this real sense of how the narrative moves between the past and the present. And I think it does that really successfully and with great ease in sort of shaping our understanding of Kwame. And you talked a little bit about kind of being conscious of both bits when you came to writing. But I wonder how, as a writer, how hard it is to strike that balance and ensure that both parts of the story have equal weight and they do what you need them to do to complement each other.
Yeah, the sort of business of having these two strands of the narrative and thinking about how they sort of work together and how it was all interwoven was really tricky. And actually, the way that I wrote the novel was that I started off writing the older Kwame section first. So I wrote maybe two or so chapters of the older Kwame's perspective, and I found it incredibly difficult. I sort of couldn't get to the bottom of older Kwame. That sounds a bit sort of vague, but I just couldn't quite see what was making him tick. I didn't understand him enough, I don't think, to begin with it.
Yeah.
So I stopped, and I hadn't intended actually to have the sort of younger, older back and forth thing, but I started thinking, okay, this 30-year-old man, I don't really get him. I'll write something about what he was like as a child. I'll just write something about him being at school. And I very rarely say this about any writing that I do, so which is why I'm kind of pausing before I
go
do
on,
say it.
Go on.
I found it so easy to write from a child's perspective. It came incredibly naturally. There was no resistance. Where with the older Kwame character, I had felt this real stopping and starting and kind of holding myself back and self-editing that wasn't allowing the writing to come. When I said, okay, I'll just write from his perspective as a child for a bit, there was no sense of a barrier at all. And so that's when I started thinking about, okay, well, this character, this young Kwame, maybe needs to have a proper space in the novel. So I then wrote the entire, sort of plotted young Kwame and wrote the entirety of that from beginning to end, really. And then every now and again, I kept thinking about, okay, older Kwame, how might that link in with this? Okay, I'll put that to one side. But my focus was really younger Kwame and, yeah, as I say, kind of inhabiting his self and speaking with his voice, I found very natural. I don't know what that says about me as a nearly 40-year-old man. About my ability to just become a child so easily, but it really was the case.
I think it makes a lot of sense because, you know, as with great therapy, we can't unlock, you know, who we are now until we've sort of unlocked and unraveled what was going on in childhood. Yeah. And I guess you were doing that from your character's point of view as well.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So that's kind of how it came about. So younger Kwame developed in response to the struggles I was having with older Kwame. And I think there was a kind of confidence I had once I had this sort of big chunk of younger Kwame stuff that enabled me to do the older Kwame stuff with a bit more ease. And also with a sense of, I knew what he was like, you know, to what you were just saying, because I had this really established sense of what he was like as a child. I could clearly see what this man would become. And so there was a real fluidity then about how the older Kwame stuff came out. And I didn't, is this true? I was going to say I didn't think about direct parallels between the two strands, if you like, as I was writing the older Kwame stuff. Yeah, that is true. When I was doing the first draft of the older Kwame stuff. But then when I started slotting them into place, I started to see that there were kind of natural, quite magical correspondences between the two halves. And then there were moments where I thought, oh, there's a sort of link that's being developed there. I can sort of sharpen that actually. So it was, yeah, it was quite a miraculous experience in some ways of writing this novel. And I think a really good reflection of maybe one of the slightly frustrating things about writing, which is that part of it is about consideration, craft, calculation, plotting, but there is a bit of it which is to do with magic essentially and happenstance and serendipity, and when those serendipitous things happen, leaning into them and making as much of them as you can.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I think there's also something in there for writers listening who, you know, perhaps if you are struggling with one or the other, you know, a younger character or an older character, that's quite a fun exercise.
Yeah, yeah.
To go somewhere else in their life and just write for fun about.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Freeing.
And I often think about, you know, writer's block, because essentially that's what was happening when I was doing the older Kwame stuff initially. I was blocked, for want of a better term. And I now try and think about writer's block not as that, as a kind of impediment or as a stop. It's an encouragement to do things in a different way. It's not the end of anything. It's not, oh, this is over. It's, okay, now we're going to travel down a different path. And you may well eventually come back to that point where the block kind of occurred. It's not an end point. It's a sort of encouragement to experiment, I think. And, you know, this novel is a kind of testament to what can be generated from writerly experiments.
Oh, what can be generated is this amazing, amazing story. So there's a couple of things I want to make sure that we touch on in this conversation in a bit more depth. And you've touched on both of them actually already in talking about Kwame as a young boy. And I think we've started to already talk about his racial identity and his mm-hmm. sense of his own heritage, but how that plays out in society, at school, and all those things for him. So it's a really key theme for Kwame. But for Marcus Felix as well. Mm. So you introduced him as the head teacher of the grown-up Kwame's school. And yeah, he's a fascinating character. And I think your approach to portraying kind of both men's sense of their own kind of racial identity, it feels really direct. It feels really fresh, authentic. And I guess, could you talk a little bit about how you did that and how you portray it? But also, I wondered if some of that's based on your own experience. And, you know, is that you weaving bits of your own identity into the fiction, or how was that process for you?
Yeah, so I was really interested in having a character at the heart of this novel who has a keen awareness of his blackness, and also an awareness that he exists in a world that isn't always necessarily inviting him to present the wholeness of his blackness. Mm-hmm. And so Kwame as a character, as both a child and an adult, does all sorts of self-censoring and self-policing things around his blackness. So, for example, you know, we were talking earlier about the sort of idea that when he's a child at school, there are moments when his white teacher sort of identifies him as Ghanaian in a way that isn't entirely comfortable to Kwame. In those moments, rather than Kwame sort of challenging in some small way the ways in which he's being kind of labeled, mistreated, he internalizes all of that. He feels awkward within himself and doesn't do anything about it. Equally, as a grown-up, there are moments when Kwame is at parents' evenings, for example, and he is interrogated by some of the parents in a way that is specifically racialized and is essentially about a distrust of a black man being able to hold the authority or the position of authority that teachers have. Kwame, again, doesn't challenge that. Instead, he literally bites his tongue, or I think he actually presses his feet into the floor as a way of kind of steadying himself and stilling the rage that is kind of rising with him when he is challenged in that way. So I really wanted to have a character who basically feels like they have to manage their blackness and to look at the processes of that, what's actually involved in that, because it's something that I've had to do in various different contexts. It's also something that a lot of my black and brown friends have had to do. And I have had numerous conversations with my black and brown friends about this, about those moments when it feels as if you are called upon to hold your blackness in check, or to not draw attention to someone else's racism, that you've got to sort of be still.
Yeah.
And we've, you know, talked to my friends about what that really feels like. And I wanted to get into, yeah, what it feels like. But then also I wanted to have a black character who seems to not have to do that. And that's Marcus Felix, who seems completely at home in their own skin and at ease with their blackness and with all the different parts of their selfhood. And I wanted to see what it looked like to have those two different approaches to being in the world rubbed up against each other, because I don't condemn Kwame for not sort of calling people out. I don't condemn him for that at all. And equally, I don't necessarily think that Marcus Felix's way is the only way to be. They're just two different ways of managing existence.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see what it would be like to have those things in conversation with each other. There's also another, maybe slightly subtle element, but an important one as well, about how those two men express their blackness, and that's to do with their cultural heritage. So Kwame is black African and Marcus Felix is from the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And historically, and this certainly speaks to my own experience and to, I think, the experiences of my black friends, there's been this stereotype that within the British African community, there's a real kind of desire to just keep your head down, don't make a fuss, get ahead. Some things might happen to you when you're out in the world that are a bit uncomfortable. Don't make a big deal out of it. On the flip side of it, there's this, again, myth, maybe stereotype, that British Caribbean people have a kind of greater confidence about their blackness and are able to sort of move through the world and express their blackness with a kind of different sense of restriction, I think. And part of that, I think, is partly to do with, and perhaps this is going on a bit of a tangent, but I think it's important, to do with what I see as how those different sort of cultural heritages are made visible in the British popular conscience. So for lots of people, I think that Black British history is about Windrush and that's it. That's it. But that's not the case at all.
Yeah.
There's a whole other thing about British African history that is so often ignored. But I think the centrality of the British Caribbean experience perhaps gives that Black group a bit more confidence, a bit more power, that's sort of different from some of the ways that British Africans operate. And so that was also feeding into the ways that these two men are. And I think there's even a bit where Kwame thinks about how his dad would view Marcus Felix. And he says something like, oh, you know, my dad would think, yeah, here's another West Indian being too loud and too big and too brash. And that is
very
that is
much
drawing,
his dad would think.
Yeah, and that is drawing on a very real and very problematic kind of schism within the Black British community. But that's also kind of informing the relationship between Marcus Felix and Kwame. And as I say, I'm not sort of suggesting that there is a set way of being black or expressing your blackness, and the novel sort of gives you a model for that. I think it's just interesting to watch these two different approaches playing out alongside each other.
Absolutely. And it can be very confronting for Kwame, can't it? I mean, it lands up being very confronting for him oftentimes. But yeah, it's really important that it's there, because it starts to affect potentially some of the shifts that we see happen within him. Absolutely. And the other thing you mentioned, that Kwame had to push down, perhaps as a boy, particularly the feelings he was starting to feel with his relationship with Yao, was around his sexual identity. And we really see how that then plays out for him as an adult. You've already said he's an openly gay man, very confident in that. I'd argue maybe he's not 100% settled in that identity. Mm. And once again, in the same way that you've got this great kind of setup between Marcus and Kwame, you've also got this sort of juxtaposition between Kwame and his best friend, Edwin, who is also openly gay, and I would say 100% settled in his identity, but he's a very wealthy white character. And so I wonder how deliberate that was, kind of setting up their friendship and their differences as a way to explore Kwame's sexuality, or his sense of his sexuality.
Yeah, I really wanted to have a character in the novel that, in terms of Kwame's sexuality, represented a kind of aspirational model for how he could be. You know, Edwin seems to be completely unfettered in terms of his sexuality. He has no fears about bringing all of his gayness to the world. His gayness is validated as well by the world. Edwin knows that he's an attractive man, and he kind of senses that other people around him find him attractive. And having that in Kwame's orbit, I think, forces Kwame to think about whether that's exactly what he wants, whether he wants to sort of try and mimic that way of being. What are the challenges to him sort of trying to be like that? Because there are real challenges to him sort of just being, you know, copy of Edwin. He can't really be like that. He can't really operate in the same way that Edwin does.
No.
And I suppose it's about really Kwame looking around him, you know, at Marcus Felix, at Edwin, at Yao, at some of the kids at the school where he teaches, and thinking about what his way through the world is. So rather than sort of thinking, I've got to be like this or I've got to be like that, I've got to sort of conform to these sorts of expectations, it's him piecing together some way to be for himself. And actually, I think he realizes, or I think he knows actually, that even though on the surface it seems that Edwin has kind of got it figured out in terms of sexuality, actually there are kind of questions there. There are kind of complications to Edwin's sense of his own gayness. And those questions are things that actually make Kwame reflect about his own way of being, you know? So I think it was important to have this other gay figure in the mix to show, you know, the various different ways of being gay. But again, ultimately, it's not like that's the model that I want Kwame to sort of have to kind of follow. It's not that I was saying that at all. It's like, well, you know, look at another way of being, you know, Kwame, and have a think about that. Does that resonate with you or not? And I think in some ways, Edwin's seeming confidence and loudness and brashness about his sexuality is a bit of a kind of cover for Kwame. It sort of means that Kwame doesn't have to think about his own issues around his sexuality. And as the novel develops and Kwame starts to find some of the ways that Edwin is a bit questionable, he's then forced to kind of look at himself.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it really encapsulates the way that Kwame, he's sort of trapped by his own insecurities, isn't he? And he's trying to be what he thinks everyone else needs him to be. And then I think there's a lovely moment, particular question he asks himself around sort of sexuality and masculinity. And he says, who made the rules that force men to be excited only about hard lines, shouts, winning and knocking over piles of blocks? And you think, yeah, who made that rule? And why are you feeling like you have to stick to that, Kwame? Like, you can find yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that's a question that younger Kwame asks of himself and of the world. I think that it's a really good question. And so often, you know, when I've been teaching younger kids, the questions that they ask are really powerful and valid and important and are things that adults should be thinking about. And, you know, it's a really valid question. Like, why is it that there are all these expectations placed around how men should behave? It actually feels quite arbitrary. And when you kind of sit and think about the arbitrariness of it, it does free you actually to think, well, these are all just constructions and creations. I can make my own, you know.
Yeah. As Kwame is doing and as you are doing with the character of Kwame. Michael, there's so many things I want to ask you, and I'm conscious that we haven't got much time left. There's lots of other things we could talk about, more about Kwame's relationship with his parents, his identity as a teacher and in the classroom. But I think it's quite important, as we're sort of wrapping up, to perhaps come back to the beginning and to that relationship between you as a writer and the reader, or the reader you have in mind. Maybe that was yourself. And also, I'm just really conscious that I've talked about, or we've talked about in this conversation, Kwame's kind of sense of difference. He's got this sense of difference, whether that's his race or his sexuality or his intelligence. And I guess I want to quantify that with those questions. I was thinking about his perception of his difference. In reality, we're all different. And I think it sort of leads me to a bigger question I wanted to end on, around the fact that, you know, for a long time in fiction or in the world, there's been a centering of one kind of identity, you know, white, cishet, able-bodied, all of those things, and then everyone else in relation to that. And perhaps that's what Kwame is feeling, you know, I'm different to this perceived norm. And so I know this is quite a big question, but did you have a sense of kind of writing against that, you know, or deliberately, or, you know, who was it that you wanted to read this and to speak into this, if you did intentionally?
Yeah, I suppose there are two questions there. So it's one about whether I had a sense that I was sort of turning away from the norm as I was writing. And then the other one was there a particular kind of group that I wanted to write towards? I think and I'll definitely kind of misremember this quotation, but Toni Morrison says something about the difference between writing on the margins and writing in the center, and what she was doing with her work, which predominantly focuses on African-American experience, was not thinking about it as marginal experience, but making that experience central So this sort of experience that the world perceives of as being on the edges or other or different, in her hands is not, it's the entire world. Not that I'm remotely suggesting that I was following in the footsteps of Toni Morrison, but I think there was some of that thinking was going on when I was writing, which was Kwame's life needs to be the kind of barometer against which everything else is judged. You know, Kwame's experience is the kind of focus. Kwame's vision is the focus. Kwame's sense of himself is the focus, rather than there being a kind of Kwame thinking about himself in relation to something else. It's his perception, as you say, which is at the heart of the novel. And sort of in relation to that, I guess, I really wanted the novel, as much as it is taking place in London, so it's a novel that occupies a very multicultural space, and there are white characters in it, and there are Asian kids in the classroom, and there are Ghanaian characters, and there are British Ghanaian characters in it. In my view, the most pivotal conversations that Kwame has, both as a young person and as an adult, are with people of colour. So throughout the novel, the conversations he has where he really has to think about himself, where he has to sort of shift his view of something in the world, where he realises that he's got something wrong, where his sort of view is expanded, those all happen with Black characters. And that was very deliberate, because it was about the centrality of those conversations. And I suppose, again, this is a long answer, this all goes back to something that we were talking about earlier, those conversations that I've had with my Black and brown friends about, partly through the experiences of racism, but just the specificities of our experiences in the world as Black and brown people, have been so important to me. They have been conversations that have been restorative, that have been nourishing, that have made me feel seen, that have made me feel safe. And so that is also what I was doing, sort of trying to shine a light on the power of those exchanges beyond anything else, above and beyond anything else. So yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking about when writing Kwame's World. I wasn't really thinking about, you know, him sort of, or me writing kind of against things that had gone before. I just really wanted to fully inhabit his very specific environment and way of thinking. And I suppose in terms of there being an audience that I might have been imagining whilst I was writing, an audience that I hoped would read this, when the book was being sold to Penguin, my very brilliant agent, Juliet Pickering, and I had a conversation with the marketing team, and Juliet asked the marketing team if they had a particular strategy for making sure that this book would specifically be able to reach Black readers, and particularly Black male readers. And they did have a strategy, and it was very convincing, and I'm really pleased to be published by Penguin, and
here you are,
et cetera. But I think I really want the book to be particularly taken up by that readership, so Black men, not because I was specifically writing with them in mind, not because I wrote it thinking, oh, there are lessons I've got to tell my community, but actually because I really want to have conversations with those readers about some of the stuff that I have sort of thrown up with this novel, things that I've raised. And it's something that I encountered with the publication of my first novel as well, that, you know, books are catalysts for conversation. You know, and I really like talking about books, as I think you can probably tell. And I'm really up for the conversations that I think this novel might spark. And some of those conversations might be quite difficult. You know, I think there are, I imagine there might be all sorts of questions about the ways in which I kind of look at Black homophobia in this novel, and the kind of some of the criticisms that I've got about the Black community in this novel. I'm really up for those conversations, as well as the conversations that are like, oh my God, Michael, you wrote my experience in this novel. Thank you. I'm just really excited about hearing what thoughts this novel generates amongst that readership in particular.
Yeah, amazing. Well, as I say, there's so much else we could delve into. And I think this has been such an interesting conversation about how you go about crafting a character's identity and pulling in so many different sort of threads and themes into that, a little bit about kind of how you bring yourself to that, and then how we as readers come to it. And certainly for me, it's thrown up loads of really interesting ideas and thoughts. So thank you so much for coming to talk about some of them with us today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for bringing us this book. And I look forward to everyone else getting to meet Kwame.
Me too.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
A very big thank you to Michael Doncor and to Holly for their time, and thank you to you for listening. If you have any questions or you want to get in touch, you can find us at Writers' Centre on Twitter and Instagram. We're on Facebook, and you can sign up to the NCW newsletter at nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk. As a UK registered charity, we rely on the generosity of our supporters to make our work possible. You can make a donation over on the website today by clicking on the Support Us page.
If you enjoyed what you heard today, please do consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving a rating and a review, because this helps other writers to find us too. Thanks again. Keep writing, and we'll catch you on the next episode of The Writing Life.